My name is Christian Ashley, a seminary student and servant of God, and you are listening to the Let Nothing Move You podcast, a proud Anazal Ministries podcast.
Welcome back, everyone, to the next episode of the Let Nothing Move You podcast. I'm your host, Christian Ashley, as we continue on through the book of Matthew. Today, we're going to be in Matthew 14, and we shall be starting off in verses 1 through 12. At that time, Herod the Tetrarch heard about the fame of Jesus, and he said to his servants, "This is John the Baptist. He has been raised from the dead. That is why these miraculous powers are at work in him. For Herod had seized John and bound him and put him in prison for the sake of Herodias, his brother Philip's wife, because John had been saying to him, 'It is not lawful for you to have her.' And though he wanted to put him to death, he feared the people because they held him to be a prophet. But when Herod's birthday came, the daughter of Herodias danced before the company and pleased Herod, so that he promised with an oath to give her whatever she might ask. Prompted by her mother, she said, 'Give me the head of John the Baptist here on a platter.' And the king was sorry, but because of his oaths and his guests, he commanded it to be given. He sent and had John beheaded in the prison, and his head was brought on a platter and given to the girl, and she brought it to her mother. And his disciples came and took the body and buried it, and they went and told Jesus." So here we have one of the many Herods we're going to see in Scripture. The Herodian dynasty is a fascinating, in Game of Thrones, to an extent, epic of debauchery and callousness and evil and scheming and death and devastation. And at that same time, they're also going to be people who've done amazing things as far as rebuilding Israel, Judea, Galilee, and Samaria, working to bring, you know, gymnasiums and coliseums and aqueducts and enriching the people to an extent. They're multifaceted people. Imagine that. People in history are multifaceted. Herod was capable of the lowercase g good. Now, this Herod in particular, though, was also very capable of evil in the uppercase, which pretty much all evil is uppercase. And he is known as the Tetrarch. That is a specific term given here for one of four rulers, Tetra, Tetrarch. That's where we get the title here of the sons and relatives of Herod who were left behind his kingdom after his death in 4 BC. And Herod the Tetrarch here is going to be someone who's actually going to live for quite some time, and up until the point of Acts, where he gets kind of what's coming to him, if I'm remembering my Herods correctly, which is very difficult to remember. So if I get that wrong, give me a little bit of grace there. But he is much like the Herod who came before him, and the Herods around him, and the Herods who would come after, both physically and spiritually. He is a wicked man who at times could do things that would bring others joy, that would help others, that even he would question his role in the world and go, "Who is this Jesus? Who is this John the Baptist? What does it mean about what they're saying? Maybe I should change myself." And yet, at the end of the day, he ends up in the point where he's at right now, where he gets misled by his own passions and pride and frailty. This is a man who has everything he could ever want, and yet he still wants more. He lusts after his brother's wife to the point where she divorces him and he marries her. And then when John does what the Pharisees aren't doing, which is enforcing the law, which is enforcing the moral law of God by saying, "You should not do this. It is not lawful for you to have her because this is an illegal divorce. Therefore, your marriage is illegitimate." What does he do? Does he put on sackcloth and ashes and weep for the sins that he's done? No. Does he say, "Oh, whatever, John," and move on with his life? No. He imprisons him. And why would he do that? Because he's afraid of John, but he's not wholly afraid of the God that John serves. He's afraid of John the prophet. He's not afraid of John the servant of God, because Herod does not believe in God. Otherwise, he wouldn't be acting the way he does. And it was a part of him that was so upset that he wanted John to be put to death, but he couldn't because Herod, like many leaders, was a slave to PR. The people would have gotten upset if John died. And even though he does what he does, the people are upset, but he lives through it because he's just that high and mighty compared to them. And God's going to use that for his own purposes. But how does this happen? Well, Herodias' daughter, we'll learn in the writings of Josephus and his complete histories, that her name is Salome. Herodias uses her to entice her stepfather with a dance. And there are many different reports of what her age would have been. Some say she was probably as old as 12, others up to 14. 14 at the time was about time when some people got married, but that's kind of irrelevant right now because she's his stepdaughter and also his niece. So there should be no enticement here. This is a man who lives by the flesh and seeks what the flesh desires. He saw an attractive young girl to him, and he desired her just as he desired that girl's mother. And as he's led astray by her, he said that he would give her an oath. He swore that he would give her whatever she asked. And Salome doesn't know what to ask. But, you know, 12, 14-year-old me, I probably wouldn't have known what to ask if I had been presented with the idea, hey, I'll give you whatever you want. I have maybe had ideas, but like narrowing them down, I would have kind of been crippled by choice. But what does Salome do? She goes to her mother. And her mother, Herodias, who hates John for daring to speak truth out against her, demands his head brought to her on a platter. And Herod, even though he hates John, doesn't want this to happen because he's afraid of the consequences. He's afraid of losing the love of the people. But he's also afraid of losing people's faith in him as a leader because he made a stupid vow. And he either has to go through with it and murder John the Baptist or not go through with it and look like he's not a man of his word and look like he's not someone to be trusted. And this is someone we see all too often in our own world, in our own lives at times. I'm not saying everyone out there is out there trying to murder people, but we are people who are driven at times by the flesh and we need to resist it. Herod did not resist the flesh. He embraced it. And how is he rewarded by flesh, by evil, by sin? With more evil, with the death of someone that to an extent he hated, but he also kind of liked because he gave in to sin. And all too often we get to the point where we embrace those sinful things and say, okay, we'll make a compromise here. No, it's not as big a sin. I'm not murdering anyone. Oh, I'm not sleeping with someone else's wife or husband. You know, I'm just telling a little white lie, or I'm just gossiping about, do you see what she was wearing? Did you see where he was the other night? And those things gather and collect dust and collect more sin. And they just end up in this ball of evil that causes death and destruction, not only to our lives, but the lives of those around us. John is being punished for something he hasn't done. He has done nothing wrong. All he has done is speak out truth. But because Herod is so mired in his sin, and because Herod has made a stupid vow, which, by the way, is also against what this book has said multiple times over, if you will remember the Pentateuch and the times we covered that, and what Jesus had to say on it earlier, if he had just been smart, if he had been wise, if he had been shrewd, if he had followed after God, this wouldn't have happened. But now a man has been murdered, martyred, for the sake of the gospel, because of the wickedness of another man. And that's something we need to be careful about. And once again, I'm not saying we're out there martyring other people, but I am saying we're harming people with our sin. When I flip out at someone because they don't get my order right, or they pass me when I'm going 9 over and they want to go 20 over, and I'm wishing death upon them, and then my driving affects how I'm feeling, I'm not loving the people around me well. When I'm angry at someone just because they said something I'm not big on and I refuse to talk to them, or I'll talk back against them, did you hear what that idiot said? And they're so stupid. I'm not loving them. I am demeaning their character. I am assassinating them without actually murdering them. And those little things build up, and sometimes people trust what we say, and they look at the other person's character kind of dies, and they're wondering, why don't people talk to me? What have I done? And they've done nothing wrong. Or maybe they did something wrong, and I made it worse by letting resentment win over, by letting my pride win over, my arrogance win over. And we can't afford to do that, especially in the church. This is how good leaders get killed, spiritually speaking, in the church, because people microanalyze everything they do, micromanage everything that they do, and say, well, okay, where were you last night, Pastor? Oh, you were with them? Don't you know who they are? Or you just wanted to spend time with yourself? How selfish are you? How dare you have a life outside of the church? Or why aren't you meeting these people here? Okay, sure. Why aren't you either? We need to be working together. And this goes from the top down. Pastors shouldn't be saying the same thing about their flocks. So, oh yeah, what about you? You're not doing anything. Said in the tone that says, oh, I'm superior to you. Yeah, if they're not doing something, if a congregation member is not doing something, the pastor automatically has the right to say, hey, get to work. This is why you're here. Just as that person would have the right to say to the pastor, you're not doing the work you're supposed to do because you're focusing on things. These things here don't matter. Do it correctly. Love well. But when we love poorly, masking it with like loving ourselves more, like Herod would, we kill ministries. We kill churches. We kill people in the congregation. We scatter flocks. And we can't afford to do that in a world that already hates us. So let's focus on what we're supposed to do. And that is serving God well, calling out evil as John did. John knew exactly what the consequences of what he said could be, and yet he did it anyways, because that's what God would demand of him. So if there is a leader out there, I don't care what party they're in, that would claim the sanctity of marriage and then go and sleep with someone else and then another person and abuse someone else, and you say, well, that man, he's of God. That woman, she's of God. You got another thing coming because they're saying one thing and doing another. Herod was loved to an extent. He wasn't like loved, let me put it that way, by the Pharisees and Sadducees because he pretty much let them get away with a lot. He didn't interfere with like, hey, your rules and whatever, get rid of them. No. He let them be. Now, there were definitely conflicts that arose between them, but for the most part, they got along because that's what evil does. Evil gets along with evil to an extent. One big happy family, because your sin's okay, my sin's okay. Therefore, when we come together, whatever. We just keep sinning because I want to keep sinning. You want to keep sinning. Herod wanted to sin. The Pharisees wanted to sin, thinking that they were righteous. And all it did was cause problems. But one bold voice stood up, pronounced judgment, righteous judgment on Herod. And what happens? He's in prison. And murdered for it. And look, that's not something easy you can just ask someone to do. That takes faith. And it's something that we need to work on. To have that boldness to speak out against those who would abuse Jesus for their own ends. Who would abuse good for their own ends. While trying to make themselves look righteous. And I said politician, it could be anyone. It could be a teacher. It could be a pastor. It could be a business owner, who cares? If they are doing evil, we call them out on their evil, assuming, of course, that we've worked out on our own, like Jesus said forever ago when we were in that part of Matthew, when he told us how to judge. Because he knows when we judge, judgment comes back on us, unless we haven't done anything wrong. Or we get to the point where we did wrong, but we made things right, and we can look back and say, I screwed up, I did bad. But I'm calling you out for what you're doing right now, and you're not repenting. And there's going to come a day when evil across the entire world is going to gain more power, is going to take down Christians, is going to call them out for daring to live righteously in a world that says that their righteousness is truth. And we're going to have to make some decisions. When do we speak up? When are we shrewd and we shut our mouths and focus on the kingdom in a different way? I don't know what God's going to tell you to do. All I know is that for me, there are certain conversations I have with people where I shut my tongue a bit because I know it's going to lead to an argument, even though I would be the one correct, both logically, factually, and morally. because right then in that moment, that's not what they need to hear. I don't agree with what they're saying. I don't build them up that way and become a false witness, but I don't create an argument out of nothing simply to be right. But I also know there's times when I'm not going to shut up, when I need to speak truth into the world. And so you need to learn that discernment, because Herod didn't have discernment, but John did, even knowing that his discernment meant death. He did it anyways. Jesus is going to do the exact same thing, knowing in his discernment that speaking truth into a world filled with hate and lies leads to death, but at that same time leads to life. Truth brings life even when those who speak truth die. It is a blessing to be a martyr. It is not something that we sign up and say, hey, that's exactly what I'm going to do. If God says to do it, you listen to him. But don't do it out of foolishness. Don't throw yourself into the lion's den simply for the sake of making yourself a martyr. Speak truth because it's true, because it's what God demands of us. And so that's why even after all this happens to John, what does Jesus do? Well, we're going to see it in the next couple of verses, but he keeps proclaiming the kingdom to the point where Herod looks at him and says, he's John the Baptist raised from the dead, because John could perform these miracles, but it's got to be him again. And that's going to kill worldviews that see themselves as righteous. Yeah, Herod didn't come to the point of a believing faith, but it did kill his worldview a bit. And that's what needs to happen. The world needs to know they are wrong and evil and that they need to change, even if they will never change. We did what we were supposed to do. Jesus, John did what they were supposed to do. So let us look at them as the example, especially as we get into these next verses, of what we're supposed to do in the threat of persecution, in the threat of being told that you're idiots, in the threat of being told that you're going to lose everything. We still have God, and we still have the church. And that is an immense blessing. So to continue on from there to verses 13 through 21. Now when Jesus heard this, he withdrew from there in a boat to a desolate place by himself. But when the crowds heard it, they followed him on foot from the towns. When he went ashore, he saw a great crowd, and he had compassion on them and healed their sick. Now when it was evening, the disciples came to him and said, "This is a desolate place, and the day is now over. Send the crowds away to go into the villages and buy food for themselves." But Jesus said, "They need not go away. You give them something to eat." They said to him, "We have only 5 loaves here and 2 fish. And he said, "Bring them here to me." Then he ordered the crowds to sit down on the grass, and taking the 5 loaves and the 2 fish, he looked up to heaven and said a blessing. Then he broke the loaves and gave them to the disciples, and the disciples gave them to the crowds. And they all ate and were satisfied. And they took up 12 baskets full of the broken pieces left over. And those who ate were about 5,000 men besides women and children. So what does Jesus do under the threat of persecution upon seeing his cousin murdered, martyred for no good reason? He preaches the gospel. He knew these people were going to follow him. So what does he do? He goes off by himself first, alone, so he can recuperate a little bit, recharge a little bit, knowing that the end result of where he's going to be is a group of people who need to hear what he has to say, who need to hear about the kingdom, who need to hear his preaching. And this is an all-day event, completely unorganized by modern standards. No tent revival would have been set up this way. No church organization would have done anything like this way. They would have been planning. They would have been, "We're going to get all this done. We need all this food ready for the people." But Jesus didn't need that. We need that because we can't do what he can do 100% all the time. But he saw opportunity even in the midst of his mourning, even in the midst of his sorrow, even in the midst of his need to get away from people. And he used it to preach about the kingdom. And how does he do it? Going to where the people would end up. The people were listening to him where he was at, but Jesus left and they came after him. And there is something important about that. Now, more than likely, most of the people in this crowd were just interested in probably seeing a miracle or just hearing what he had to say as some great teacher. But there were people in that crowd who were going to come to a saving faith. And Jesus did not abandon them, even knowing that there were people who were going to reject him in that same crowd, even after listening to him all day speak so eloquently, speak so truthfully. He went to the sheep who needed their shepherd. And then he provided for them. deliberately going to a place where they couldn't gather resources themselves, to the point where the disciples are like, Jesus, man, like, hey, these people need to eat. They need to leave. Well, yeah, that's what people need to do. Our bodies, we need to eat after some time. But there was something far more important there, in that they had a need. And what does he do? He has compassion on them and healed their sick and taught the good word to them, knowing they would get hungry, knowing they had a physical need alongside their spiritual needs, knowing this conversation was going to happen. Jesus uses it to test the disciples. And what do? They only see the physical. And yes, absolutely. When you have a large group of people, you better have food around. Otherwise, you're going to have a riot. But that's not the point of what Jesus was doing. The point was to meet their needs and him having compassion on people that he chose to have compassion on. Right? Tell Jesus that the crowds need to go away. They have to get something to eat. Say, well, no, you give them something. Now, some people will look at this and say, well, the disciples, they just needed to have enough faith to manifest a miracle themselves, and they could have transmutated the bread and fish that they had there. Like, sure, I mean, I can see the argument for that, but I think the idea more is that they're missing who Jesus is. They know of his power, they know of his majesty, and yet they don't have enough faith that he can take care of the situation. And they act as if Jesus doesn't understand what's going on. These people are hungry, Jesus. He knows this. And they don't respond well. So he tests them. They fail. And then what happens next? We get one of the greatest miracles you've probably heard preached multiple times over in Scripture, of the bread and the fish being multiplied in a way that defies physics, defies science, defies the creative natural order of the world as we understand it, except for the fact that the creator who made those rules is right there, and he destroys those rules for the sake of loving people. This is a supernatural miracle only achievable by the power of God. We don't have this ability, this power, unless God were to tell us to do so and we were then to perform that miracle. I doubt we'd ever be able to do that, but if he said to do it, we'd do it. And this is just another part of Jesus having compassion on the people there. Some people argue about the numbers. We know for sure about 5,000 men, and then there are women and children, and, you know, outdated reasons for why the women and children weren't considered, all that mess. So there's probably around 10,000-ish people there. Some people have said 20,000. Some people say maybe 6. No one knows. It's not focused on. But the point is, there's a large number of people. The impossible is being done right in front of them, because these people don't have the food. They see Jesus has 12 people beside by his side and none of these resources, and yet somehow they're fed and they get to be fed by the word too. That's part of the miracle. The miracle isn't just the physical thing being done here. It's also the supernatural spiritual part of people seeing who Jesus is and what he's capable of doing and his love for them. That's what most of them, hopefully, are responding to. We don't get like an exact breakdown of, okay, out of those, you know, 10,000 people, you know, 6,972 came to faith that day. It's not there. The Gospels choose not to focus on it. If God wanted us to know the answer, he'd have put that right there. But instead, Matthew focuses on both of the needs being met. And that's exactly what Jesus does for us. He meets our physical needs through ways that we could never imagine, and he meets our spiritual needs. We need a savior. We need someone by our side, helping us out, making us realize that we aren't good enough, that we need help. And then when he comes to help, we embrace that help. We submit to his help. And then we go out and we help others, doing things we never would have done without the effect that Jesus has had in our lives. There are many great charities out there in the world that know nothing of Jesus Christ and have helped countless people. But all they ever did is meet the physical needs of those people. A good Christian ministry, a good Christian charity does both. Sees they don't have food, they don't have clothes, they don't have jobs. Let's give them those things. And then at that same time, teach them those things don't bring you happiness. Those things aren't reliable. Only Jesus is. Submit to him. As we also meet your physical needs, let us meet your spiritual needs. And if a church focuses on one over the other, they are a failure. Yes, absolutely. Every person in this world should come to a saving faith in Jesus Christ. But if you don't help out someone in need, all you've said is that you don't care about them. And all you ever do is just give them what they physically need. Then all you've done is start a handout program for people who know nothing of who Jesus is. And there are plenty of other ministries and charities out there in the world that can do that. You have to be both. Otherwise, we fail. If we don't meet both needs, we don't love these people as well as we think we do. So let us go out there and love them well. Show them the same compassion that Jesus showed them. And we'll go from there to verses 22 through 33. Immediately, he made the disciples get into the boat and go before him to the other side while he dismissed a crowd. And after he had dismissed the crowds, he went up to the mountain, on the mountain by himself to pray. When evening came, he was there alone. But the boat by this time was a long way from the land, beaten by the waves, for the wind was against them. And in the fourth watch of the night, he came to them walking on the sea. Fourth watch of the night would be about anywhere from 3 to 6 a.m. in the morning. But when the disciples saw him walking on the sea, they were terrified and said, "It is a ghost." And they cried out in fear. But immediately Jesus spoke to them, saying, "Take heart, it is I. Do not be afraid." And Peter answered him, "Lord, if it is you, command me to come to you on the water." He said, "Come." So Peter got out of the boat and walked on the water and came to Jesus. But when he saw the wind, he was afraid and beginning to sink. He cried out, "Lord, save me." Jesus immediately reached out his hand and took hold of him, saying to him, "O you of little faith, why did you doubt?" And when they got into the boat, the wind ceased. And those in the boat worshipped him, saying, "Truly, you are the Son of God." So after meeting both their physical and spiritual needs, what does Jesus do with the crowds? Tells them to leave. They have a life outside of the physical church that they were at that time. And then what does he do? Does he go back to work? No. He goes on his own to pray. Good things were achieved that day. Lives were changed in ways that we couldn't even fathom. But Jesus had also been speaking all day long with a large group of people. He needed time for himself. And as the introvert of introverts, I understand that so much. God has done a mighty work in me to get me to the point where I love other people and where I'm willing to be in ministry, to the point where I would love to be a pastor somewhere and do this every Sunday, even more days if I had my way. I also need to recharge. I need to get away from people. I can't be on 24/7. I don't know how people out there are capable of doing that. And even those same people who it seems like to me have this superpower of always being fully charged, always being able to go in the crowd, even they need rest. They have a limit. So Jesus, introvert, extrovert, I don't know. Doesn't matter. The point is, he did something as a model, as a teacher for us, that Matthew puts down for us to learn about him, and that he took time out of his ministry to rest and stay in reflection and prayer. That is one of the most useful things any leader in the church, or any person in the church for that matter, can learn from what is happening here. Take time to rest and get things right between you and God. Focus on what matters. Say, "Lord, thank you for the service I was able to attend to today. Lord, thank you for the service I was able to lead today. Thank you for the people around me who are learning. Thank you for everything you've done here. And I have this concern, Lord. I have this to pray for. Hey, they walked up to me and they told me that their mother was in the hospital. Hey, their son is failing his class. Like, Lord, pray for that situation. Lord, over that situation. Show up in a mighty way." That's precisely what Jesus does. So if there's any person we should ever learn how to do what we do from, it is he. He leaves everything behind to get alone with God and pray. And when that's done, when the rest is over, what does he do? Continue resting? No. He goes back to get the work done because there are 12 people around him who still don't get him. They've made some good answers. They've made some good choices, but they're not there yet. They need some more help. So knowing they need help to have more faith in him, what does he do? Sets up a scenario to where they're separated. and he has to come to them in their time of need. How do you think this storm happened on the Sea of Galilee? Do you think it's some coincidence? You think Jesus was surprised by these events, like the disciples were? Absolutely not. Jesus knows the area that he lives in. The Sea of Galilee is a very tumultuous place to be at times, because the way the weather systems work there, the way the temperature works and all that mess, flash storms can happen at any point in time with very little warning, even today with modern technology at our hands. And if you've ever seen the little rinky-dink ships they used to travel in back in the day, you'd know, wow, those aren't exactly what I'd call impressive specimens of a vessel. It would be so easy for one wave, just a little bit taller than that ship, to cause everyone to capsize and everyone to die, because most people at that time didn't know how to swim, even if you were a fisherman, as some of the disciples were. So of course they're going to be afraid. Of course they're going to be in distress, because they're in a very stressful, scary situation. But what do they do in their terror? Do they immediately go and say, Jesus, Lord, help us? Do they cry out to God? No to either of those. They panic. They lose focus. All they can focus on is what is right in front of them. And we are so very much like that. We see the storm, and in the midst of that storm, all we can see is what we're trying to do at that current moment to survive. We forget the past. We forget the future. We forget the present, except for the fact of where we're at. We don't know that God is Lord of all that time, and we lose focus. And we get scared and hopeless and think, there's no way I can get out of this alive. There's no way I can pay this bill. I'm going to go to jail. There's no way that my brother can be healed of the sickness. There's no way that my wife is ever going to come back. And we lose ourselves in that hopelessness. And it becomes that much harder in a world that's already hard to see Jesus for us to see him. But what does Jesus do for them? The same thing he does for us. He shows up to be with them in the midst of their storm. And notice, does he immediately calm the storm? No. He speaks to them instead in the midst of the storm. And he even dares to make a declarative statement, Ego eimi. I am, and translated here as it is I. That sound familiar to you? I am. Well, it should, if you've been with us since Exodus. I am that I am. I am is here. Take heart. I am is here. Do not be afraid. God is literally with them in the form of man and God. That should bring comfort not only to them, but to us. The great I am was right there in the midst of him, and he's right there in the midst of us as we're suffering, as we're going through those storms, as we're unable to figure out what we should be doing, how we're supposed to respond, what we're supposed to do, who we're supposed to talk to, how we're supposed to solve problems. I am here. And let's see how the disciples respond to that first. Well, we have 1 out of 12 give a somewhat favorable reply after they had all said that he's a ghost. So, hey, guess what? The belief in ghosts has been around for quite some time. But Peter, good old Peter, brazen as ever, impetuous as ever, not thinking through things as possible ever, Peter, says, Lord, if it is you, command me to come to you on the water. There are several important things being said there. They recognize Jesus' voice even in the midst of their peril and their stress. But only 1 out of the 12 responds, as is recorded for us. And the way he responds is incredibly important, because there are positive aspects to what Peter is saying, and there's very negative aspects to what Peter is saying. He sees Jesus walking on the water, and he recognizes Jesus has the power to do so. So even in the midst of everything going on, in the midst of the peril, he says, well, if Jesus can do it, if he wants me to do it, I can do it also. Right. Great call. However, he then dilutes what is a positive reflection with very negative words. Lord, if it is you, command me to come to you on the water. There should be no if there. Peter knows Jesus's voice. Peter knows Jesus's power over nature. He's seen him 100 times before do things that no one else is capable of. And yet there's still that little bit of doubt in there. that hasn't gotten him to the point where he fully believes in Jesus as his savior. And that's what's going to cause the turmoil we see. Because Jesus says, come, you're going to walk on the water with me. So Peter does it. To his credit, he gets off. No one else follows him. None of the other disciples are doing what Peter's doing. And Peter walks on the water. But then Peter does what we all do. And he gets re-distracted by the storm. Jesus pulls us out for a bit. We get our head above the water and say, oh, he's still here. I can make it out of this. Everything's going to be fine. And we're looking at him, everything's okay. But then we look to the side, we look behind us, we look to the left, and we lose sight of him. And we go underwater again. And we're not able to see clearly. And we're drowning. And we need help. And we can't focus, even though we were just there. Jesus just helped me out. But now I'm back in distress and I can't think of it again. I can't think of the positive. And Peter is right there. And he loses sight of Jesus. And he says the right thing. Lord, save me. Because his faith is weak, but he still trusts enough in Jesus to know he has power. But he should have had the faith to say, if Jesus wanted me to walk, I can continue to walk on the water and not drown and not be in trouble. But Jesus, being the loving man that he is, knowing who Peter is eventually going to end up to be, doesn't give up on him. And I think there's something incredibly important there to leaders that we need to learn. Is there going to be times when we're very tempted to just say, this idiot, I've poured everything into them. And they just don't get it. So I'm going to throw them away. Now, there are times when you need to get rid of people because they're not helpful, because they're not loving, because they're false members of a church and they need to go. That's its own separate thing. I'm talking about people who are in the midst of learning and we get frustrated because they don't get it. Why don't you understand what I do? I've told you everything you need to get to just be like me. Just understand. Well, guess what? Not everyone's shaped the way we are. Not everyone's molded to have the minds that we do. What seems obvious to me is not going to be obvious to the new convert or even to the person who's been in church for years and is finally struggling with their faith to the point where they need to know they need to work on stuff. So we need patience and we need to hold our hand outstretched so that when they are gasping for air, when they're underwater and they can see that hand, they reach out for it and we can pull them up with us just like Jesus does here. And we also need to speak as plainly as he does, as lovingly and truthfully as he does. O you of little faith, why did you doubt? There are some people out there who say, oh, Jesus would never say something like that. Jesus loves. Jesus would never be harsh. No good teacher would ever be harsh to one of their students. Lies. Incompetence. Poor exegesis. That is precisely what a good teacher would do in a loving way for a student who has done something stupid to get them to recognize their stupidity and yet still love them enough to teach them, you screwed up. Here's what we're going to do, or here's what you need to do. And very implied in what Jesus is saying is that you have little faith, therefore you need to have more faith so you're not doubting needlessly like this. This is not the doubt of, I don't know if this all is all real. Did Jesus really come back from the dead? Is the Bible true, or is it just written collectively over thousands of years by different authors who had no control by God over anything? That's a different doubt. This is out of he knows better and he still falls and succumbs to it. And that's something we should always avoid. And even though Peter had done next to nothing to deserve it, the disciples had definitely not done anything to deserve it, Jesus calms the water and the storm. And what is their response? Truly, you are the Son of God. Magnificent statement. They're so close. They're almost there. And you would think, well, Christian, you just said he's the Son of God. Doesn't it mean they're Christians? Let's look about what they do later. Let's see the things that they say and what they do. I'm not seeing much fruit, if any at all. But this is the start of something. And this is something to be praised. So don't see that I'm being negative and cynical about this. This is a good thing. Truly, you are the Son of God, because only the Son of God is capable of doing what Jesus did. That is a good thing that they recognize that. They're not fully there yet, but they're getting there. Another hurdle has been jumped on their way to salvation. And that is such a beautiful thing. And it's something we should be happy about with the people that we're ministering to, evangelizing to. When they make correct statements, it doesn't automatically mean, oh, they're on part of the team. It means they're asking the right questions. It means they're giving the right answers. But just because someone says that Jesus is God doesn't mean that they're on the team. Anyone can say that. It takes faith. It takes true belief to actually know that that's real and not just something that I expect you to say because this is a discipleship class or whatever. So let's be mindful of that as we're counseling people, as we're loving on them, as we're teaching them. That just because they give a right answer doesn't automatically mean they're on the team, but it is a sign of improvement. Or it is a sign of someone who is on the team and knows the right answer and is saying the right thing. We need to learn discernment in that. Learn how to love them well. And instead of just accepting everything they say as fact and then having confirmation bias of, oh, they said this, therefore they must be, they're Jesus's. They're part of the children of God. Like, let's be wise about this. Let's be shrewd about this. So we don't make people who aren't Christians think that they are. Because there's been far too many people out there in a church who've been taught poorly by people who meant really well, who wanted to love them really well and just weren't up to the task completely because they didn't ask the right probing questions, because they didn't make sure that they got it, that they weren't just regurgitating information just to please the teacher. Or someone who came from the American schooling system, that's precisely what we're taught to learn, whether or not they'll say that out loud. And we can't become that way in the church. We can't be regurgitators of the word. We need to be retainers and students of the word. A student isn't someone who can just tell you something and just to get a passing grade. A student is someone who is studying that thing so that they know the answer, they're prepared to give the answer, they know why it's the answer, and they can then tell someone else why it's the answer so that they can become teachers one day themselves. We are all called to be students of the word and then teachers and doers of the word. And I'm going to finish off today with verses 34 through 36. And when they had crossed over, they came to land at Gennesaret. And when the men of that place recognized them, they sent around to all that region and brought to him all who were sick and implored him that they might only touch the fringe of his garment. And as many touched it, they were well. They were made well. A smaller part here, but still something equally powerful. Jesus' story is being spread wider. This is on the northern, northwest part of the Sea of Galilee, closer to Capernaum, the land of Gennesaret. So these people know who Jesus is as far as hearing stories, but now they've come to confirm it for themselves. And after hearing the stories, they also have enough faith to say, I don't even need to touch you fully. I don't even need to ask you. If I just touch your garment, Lord, I can be healed. And it doesn't focus too much. Matthew doesn't focus too much on what happens after this for these people. But there's parts of it that want to be a little more optimistic than others, where it sounds like these people are kind of getting it. And that's how we should respond to Jesus. We should know, Lord, you have the power. If you will it to be done, even if I just did this, even if this is all I'm able to give, even if this is all I'm able to do, you can do mighty things. You can do things that put us all to shame. So let me give as much of my faith as I'm able to offer right now. Lord, I'm working on it. Lord, I want to be better than who I am. Lord, I believe that if you could do this, you can do that too. So just thinking about these things, walking through our daily lives, like, what is that thing that we think he can't do? We're not going to say that part out loud, that we think he can't. We secretly believe it. And I'm going to challenge us. Ask him, Lord, do that thing. Lord, restore this marriage. Lord, heal this person. Lord, help me find that job. Lord, help me to love that person I hate. Lord, bring peace to this world. Whatever that impossible thing is, ask him. And then look at the ways that that prayer has been answered. If it hasn't been answered fully or at all, don't get discouraged. Don't grow weak. It may not be his will to do it right now or ever. We don't know, but all we can do is trust in him to do what he knows is the right thing, that is part of his plan. Let's submit and follow him. Well, thank you guys for all you do. Please get a chance to be a 5-star review on your podcasting platform of choice. With help us with the ratings there to help us find more people. Feel free to share the show with friends and family. If you're interested in my own fiction writing, you can find my works at starvingwritersguild.com or on Amazon by searching for the name MC Ashley. If you're all interested in some further solid studies into the Bible and its teachings, then check out the other members of the Anazal Ministries podcasting network. You can find me specifically on Systematic Ecology, Why I Don't Like, Friday Night Frights, and Some Joyful Noises. You can contact me at letanythingbepodcast@gmail.com. I'd like to extend a special thank you to Joshua Noel for the editing that he does and for the music he has to the podcast. And with all that in mind, God bless you in accordance to his will and not mine. And allow me one more time to remind you, let nothing move you.